Hey, yo, we about to tear it up. Hey, yo.
Break for break, get down.
This right here is how we do it. Break it down.
It's the Breaking Atoms podcast. We break things down to the very last compound. My name is Simit, a.k.a. the potty mouth of the South.
And my name is Chris Mitchell, a.k.a. the actual factual.
Yes, man.
What's up,
back.
Man? What's up?
We are back.
What's up, man? What's up?
One of those episodes where I don't want to talk to you. I don't really care how you are. I'm just assuming you're okay.
You don't care how
okay.
I am. You don't care how I am in general. I could be dying inside and you'd never know. This isn't a safe space. This podcast is not a safe space.
Well, it's a safe space for the guests.
Yeah.
It's a safe space for the fans,
mm-hmm.
the guys who rock with us, the day ones, and the guys who are being introduced to this album for the first time, like someone discovering the score for the first time, or Carnival, or House of Pain, or Cypress Hill, whoever.
House of Pain was Tommy Boy, but go ahead.
I know. I said it. That's why I said Cypress Hill. I know. But I'm just saying.
I was going to make a very inappropriate joke, but go ahead.
No, don't do that. I'm just saying, you're here with us. I love you guys, but you're here in it, and I don't care in it. You're here now, in it. So that's it, in it.
That's fine, bro. Now, one day, me and you're going to fight.
I think, you know.
You know what? You've got a lot of energy behind the Zoom. But one day I'm going to see you, bro.
Wow.
Now, one day I'm going to see
what?
You.
That's the new thing. Not Twitter fingers. Yeah. It's energy behind the Zoom.
Yeah, man. You got that Zoom energy. When I see you, I'm going to box your pret sandwich out your hand and say, what?
You know when someone's real, when they say, I'm going to box you, innit?
Yeah. No, do you remember the Flip Mode squad? When the album said, why? You want to box? Move before I box you, man. I'm going to box you. When me see you, I'm going to box you.
Box and rock. Our old school terms from the 90s.
If someone said they're going to box you in your face, listen, yeah. Listen, you better think of an escape route.
Yeah. Exit plan.
Yeah, because that's old school badness. It's not about, I'm not going to come and shoot you. I'm not going to come and stab you. I'm going to box you.
Box you. Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. Like Jack Bauer used to box man sometimes,
yeah,
isn't
I'm going
to
box you up, bruv.
All right. Moving swiftly on from boxing. Today we have another legend.
I'm going to box you up, bro.
Yeah. Today we have another legend of this culture that we so fondly love. Chris has lost it, yo. No, we have a legend, bro, and another one, and someone to talk about the music side, but they're also their journey into rap and how they became part of folklore in rap music. And we're talking about Chris Schwartz, who has a book out called Rough House. And talks about the journey, but also the person who is responsible for some of the greatest albums ever to come out with such a lasting impact. And acts like Criss Cross, bro. Like, you forget about how Criss Cross and how popular they were.
Bro, they went on tour with Michael Jackson, bro.
It's madness.
Mm.
It's great. Like, thinking about it, I didn't mention it because Chris was like, I don't care. Maybe. But the Fugees, when they went on the world tour, they took Nonchalant.
5 o'clock in the morning.
Morning. Yes. Do you know who the DJ was for Nonchalant?
Who?
A person by the name of Young Guru.
Yeah?
Young Guru was DJ for Nonchalant. 5 o'clock in the morning was buzzing. As a person, obviously, he's from Delaware. HU, Howard University, and New Jersey. I can never pronounce it, but Newark. I can never pronounce it correctly because it's... No, we call it Newark, but there's a specific tang to the
don't say it like them, innit? Say it like,
say it like it,
you, innit?
Just saying.
Newark, innit?
Yeah, I'm going to say it like me. Newark, right? Anyway, he went on tour. I think he was maybe 20, 21 years old, maybe. And he went on the world tour with the Fugees.
That's incredible.
And then they came back and he was engineering and mixing Nonchalant's first or second album.
First one. I think it might be... It's called Until the Day.
Right.
When you speak to Guru, though, tell him, because I know he has a very rich archive, I need the K-Def remix of 5 o'clock in the morning. He will have it.
He will have it. You can ask him yourself.
No, man, I'm doing it. Yo, who upset him, man?
Who, Young Guru?
Yeah, he was talking some things on the timeline this morning. He said, listen, I'm not trying to be famous, bruv.
No. See, that he's my constant inspiration, right? That's my guy, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, like as MCs and rappers, you know, most of our verses are aimed at what Talib Kweli calls the ubiquitous whack MC.
Wow.
Yeah. He was aiming at a ubiquitous target this morning, and I was here for all of it.
I was going to message him and say...
Leave that man alone today. Leave him alone.
I was like, leave him. Yeah. But he also then inspired me to write my mess on Twitter.
We'll talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the intro and the outro. But I wanted to get to Chris Schwartz. Because the listeners don't care about me and you. They care about Chris Schwartz.
It's not a safe space, isn't it?
It's not a safe space for you. Only for you. But this is an individual, a legend who has been part of so much legendary music. And when you hear this interview and hear him talk and understand where he's coming from, his perspective, you get to realize he is like one of those, like I always talk football references, right? He's one of those great football managers that may have not been able to fit someone on their team, but knew the talent that someone had, right? And he put together a team at Rough House that worked for them, and they sold 100 plus million records and were responsible for some of the greatest artists to come out of, you know, Miseducation. Lauryn Hill is still talked about today as one of the greatest MCs ever.
And that's
Miseducation.
And that's based on her performance on those two Fugees albums and her first solo. The only solo she's done to date.
And what we didn't talk to Chris about, and we will in a follow-up, is how, well, he knew the greatness of those albums. People at
Sony,
you know, I guess Sony,
didn't see that.
They didn't get it. And that's important because he stuck by his guns. And I told him off air, I was so psyched to speak to him. It's very important, bro.
One of the things, and before we get to the interview, I think it's something that we can take with us through life, just how he ran his business. And it's about seeing the potential in other people before they actually see it in themselves. And seeing what they can become as opposed to what they are in the present time.
That's leadership. That's leadership. Definition, leadership. So Chris is not only part of hip-hop folklore, but he was a leader to that. We didn't even ask him about how he managed the ego of those massive artists at the time.
Chatty House, you know, man. We'll have it for the Chatty House.
This, I'm telling you, man, that's a leader right there. And I fucking... I swore now. Potty Mouth of the South. This should be like a jar.
No. It's Live the Brand, innit?
All right, sorry. But no, I'm so excited. Genuinely, this is a great moment for me personally. I'm sure it is for you, Chris. But to speak to Chris, to understand the inner workings of some of those albums and things that have been so ingrained as part of my childhood and growing up in rap, I'm forever grateful. And I love the fact that we have this platform in order to speak to people so that they can lend their voice and to contribute their voice to the culture. So I'm very grateful for that. But this is Chris Schwartz, Breaking Atoms. Check it out. It's another special episode of the Breaking Atoms podcast. Today we have, well, someone who's been part an architect of our childhood as rap fans, someone who's been in the business of hip hop since the early 80s, celebrating now their 35th anniversary. We're talking to the one, the only Rough House Records, Rough Nation, Chris Schwartz on the Breaking Atoms podcast. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Simon. How you doing? How are you, Chris?
I'm good. Excited.
We are very excited. I've got my cassettes to the side of me. I've got my vinyl here. when the opportunity arises, I'm just going to show it. Because like I said in the intro, you are very much part of our education and the music and the output and the diversity of music, I should say, that was put out through the label has very much shaped how we love hip hop. So thank you for that. And you were mentioning just off air about the 35th anniversary.
Right.
Talk to us about that before we get into your kind of the entry point of you into the music business.
I guess it was about a week and a half ago. It was 35 years when I met my partner in Rough House, Joe Niccolo. So we didn't start distributing records till a little bit after that as Rough House, but that's sort of like the anniversary of the partnership, so to speak.
Okay. So let's, yeah, go on.
Well, I mean, are you familiar with the whole Schoolie D part of our story?
We were going to get into that. Right. So I mean, Schoolie D is let's go there. Schoolie D is very much an architect of, especially in Philadelphia, of the hip hop and the rich lineage that's come through that. No, now we talk about Meek Mill, we talk about Beanie Siegel, but Lady B, Schoolie D, we're going, you know, very much back now. Very, I mean, the original gangster, really, Schoolie D.
Yeah.
And I know the story. Obviously, I know it's no good for me to tell it. But talk to us about that point where you've gone Bill Cosby, the comedy record that was recorded in prison, to Schoolie D. What attracted you there to then go, right, I'm going to mess with this guy? And didn't he slam the door on your face the first time you went to see him?
Yeah, he did.
Right, let's start there. Let's talk about Schoolie D. Let's go there.
Well, I started out, you know, I'm a musician, and I joined the service when I was 17. I was in the Navy. And when I got out, I played in bands. And something that I was into in particular was electro-funk and electronic music. I was a huge Kraftwerk fan. My partner in that, a guy named Jeff Coulter, and I, we performed shows in Philadelphia doing, you know, electronic music. And so I started doing, we were like the first people to own a Roland TR-808. We had it before it was even available on the market. And what happened is that we started doing drum programs for, you know, these young hip hop groups, because hip hop at that time, and I'm talking like right prior to Schoolie D, if you looked at what was going on, you know, there was very little in terms of what was, you know, programming for the radio, that what was available. You had the Sugar Hill Records and you had Curtis Blow, you had stuff like that. But up until Schoolie, the stuff that was kind of like breaking at radio was more the electro-funk stuff. And that was like really more the club mix show, you know, Planet Rock, and then eventually like Nucleus, Jam On It, stuff like that. So I was working at a little record label in West Philly called Nice Town Records. It was like a one-man operation. And he bought me into, you know, to help work the, you know, black charts for Billboard, for black album charts and stuff like that. And he had Bunny Sigler. He had a couple, you know, ex-Philly International artists. But the one record that he was going to be the big thing was he had a Bill Cosby Live at Grade for Prison. Now, at the time, Bill Cosby had the Cosby Show, which was huge. It was the biggest show on television. And so the guy who owned the label was kind of banking on that and Bill Cosby's popularity at the time to kind of be able to sell this comedy record. And, you know, I wasn't the greatest gig in the world, but I did it because I wanted to learn the business, because I eventually wanted to start my own label. And one day I went down to his office and we were talking and I saw these records stacked up against the wall. And there was a bunch of 12 inches of a song called Gangster Boogie that I've heard many times. And it was an artist, Schoolie D from West Philly. And Schoolie had been there that morning and was talking to my boss about distributing his records. And my boss, you know, wasn't interested and sent him on his way. And I filched Schoolie's number off of his desk and I went back upstairs. I called him up and, I basically quit that day and went to Schoolie's house to meet with him. And yeah, he did answer the door. He said he was getting ready to take a shower and he just shut the door and kind of left me standing there on the porch. So I got a hold of his lawyer, and after a couple mishap, you know, meetings that didn't happen, we finally got together and we, you know, started really formed the real record label, Real Schoolie D Records, and then eventually did the PSK Gucci time, then did the album, did the tours and everything. And it kind of, you know, went really well, sold hundreds of thousands of records. And then, you know, it seemed to me that Schoolie, Jesse, wasn't real, you know, he didn't really seem to have, you know, we did some artists, so Robbie B, DJ Jazz, Royal Ron, Pimp Pretty. We did some records, but at the end of the day, I don't think he was really interested in the label part of it. So we ended up signing with Jive Records. And then from there, I started Rough House with Joe Niccolo.
So tell me about the contrast in your styles and personalities and why Joe was such a perfect yin to your yang in terms of Rough House?
Because Joe at the time was mixing all the hip hop records out of Philadelphia. I mean, you know, he did the Jazzy Jeff Fresh Prince. I mean, Jeff and Will were like 17 hanging out in the studio back in the day. And he did all those records. He did the Hilltop Hustlers, MC Breeze. He did the company that had these records was Pop Art. And Pop Art also had Roxanne Shanté. So he did those records. I did the Roxanne Shanté video, Roxanne's Revenge, at our house in West Philly where I lived. We shot the video there.
Okay.
And yeah, the guys from Mr. Magic and Marley Marl, they slept on my couch that night. I'll never forget. Wow. Coming down in the morning and they were watching cartoons, eating cereal in my living room.
I mean, look, man, that was the life back then. I wish I could do that now.
Yeah. But, you know, that was kind of the pedigree. You know, it was about, you know, Joe was, what I liked about Joe was that, you know, back in the early 80s, you know, if you do a hip hop record, you go into a studio, a typical engineer, you lay down a drum beat, and the first thing they're going to do is that they're going to want to clean it up, and they're going to want to make it sound all clean and antiseptic. And Joe basically was counterintuitive. He made it really dirty and big and bombastic, you know? And that was the whole thing. I felt we had, you know, I had learned a lot about, you know, manufacturing, distribution, marketing, and promotion. And he knew he had the whole mixing thing down. And so we figured, you know, we had enough of a good pedigree that we gave it a shot at doing a label.
Okay. All right. Shout out to Joe Nicola and his drums.
Yeah.
The Butcher. Him and his brother.
You know
right?
what? The Butcher, Joe the Butcher Nicola. I was always anyone who is called the Butcher, because I'm a big wrestling fan, there's been a few Butchers and they were always very serious people. Abdullah the Butcher, now you've got Blade and the Butcher, and Joe the Butcher Nicola came first. I mean, after Abdullah, so respect to Joe Nicola.
He was called the Butcher. I don't know if you guys remember a song called Catch Me, I'm Falling by Pretty Poison.
I'm not familiar with it.
Not me.
Yeah, he was a big hit record, and still is actually is a recurrent. But he did the editing back. You know, this is back when we edited tape. You know, it's not like it is now. And editing half inch tape with a razor blade and scotch tape to do edits and everything. And he chopped that record up pretty well. That he was given that nickname, but coincidentally, him and his twin brother Phil. Their father was a butcher. So,
okay. So there's two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's twin brothers.
Okay,
twin
Joe and Phil. Joe.
Yeah.
Sons of butchers. Okay. I'm
doing a lot of stuff with Phil right now. Phil is in the process of opening up a pressing plant. Phil's a Grammy winning producer and, you know, he's done a lot of big records and everything. But, yeah, him and another partner opened up a state-of-the-art vinyl pressing facility. And so we're doing a lot of, I started a vinyl distribution company and, you know, trying to help lead the, you know, the resurgence of vinyl, trying to participate in it and, you know, very excited about it.
Dope. Absolutely. Good luck with that.
And the,
thanks.
The name Rough House came from a rock band, but who spelled it differently. Am I correct? There was a tape in the studio.
Yep, it was a tape on a lawyer's desk that Joe picked up. And he said, hey, this would be a great name for a band, but it was R-O-U-G-H. And I agreed, but I said, we need to change it up. We need to give it a little bit more, you know.
The hip-hop spelling.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need that.
It was a smart move. Let's talk about Questlove interning at Rough House Records.
Yeah.
How old was he? Because obviously later, you know, there's the $2,000 for the video. We'll talk about the roots later and the similarities to Fuji, etc. But Questlove, who hired him there? How old was he? And what was he like as an intern?
He was hired by, I guess, Rose and myself. He showed up to an event we were doing. what was an event. It was some type of event in Philly where somebody was getting honored, and Rose and I were there, and Rose was my head of retail promotion. And he approached us, he talked to Rose, and we said, yeah, sure, come on down Monday, be there. And he came and he did the work, and he was there for a while.
And how, what happened with this, the $2,000 for the video? What video was it?
Pass the Popcorn.
Wow. So that then leads me on to, we'll talk about the success of Rough House and all the artists, but there were some groups, artists that you passed up on.
Right.
The Roots being one, House of Pain and Rest of Development. As a rap fan.
Right.
I need to know what went into the thinking. Was it because you had so many huge acts, some of them too similar? Was it just too much RAM at the time? What was it
too
that
much.
Made you pass on the Roots,
much.
House of Pain? And
it was, we could only, you got to remember, we were a really small company. And, you know, it's as far as House of Pain, we got a demo, but we were like, you know, right in the thick of Cypress. And, you know, we had other stuff going on. We were making a Crisscross record and we had Tim Dog. I mean, it was just, you only have so much capacity. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you look back on it and saying coulda, shoulda, woulda, right? In hindsight, it's always 20/20, but that's kind of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Arrested Development, you know, that was a tough one because I wasn't confident through that we could have done the same type of job for them that with Sony that they ended up doing. I guess it was with EMI that they signed.
I think so. EMI.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just didn't know how we were going to, you know, going to make a group like that work. I mean, because at the time with Sony, we didn't have the luxury of the artist development that we're able to have later on.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And that, and just a point on the 2020, it's absolutely true. I think we sometimes go down the rabbit hole. I do too, of going, oh, I wish that happened. But in the moment and the time, the actual popularity of Rough House and what you guys were doing was game changing. It was absolutely game changing. That's why I say, was it kind of too much RAM? Because there's only so much capacity a company can have. And I think what should be celebrated is all those successes that
right.
you did
well,
have.
Well, you know what
have.
Else too? People really, you know, people don't realize back then what went into signing an artist and making a record, right? Because, you know, you look at it now, anybody can be a label. You can go get your thing, go to an aggregator and upload songs and everything like that. But in the traditional sense of a record label, first off, you're you know, we were very successful early on. So now, like, you know, when we signed an artist, these people were going out there getting, you know, marquee name lawyers and these contracts. They were CBS, you know, agreements that we were using as our form Rough House agreements because it had to coincide with our distributor and everything. And these were like, you know, 120 page agreements. And then beyond that, then there's the whole administration of making the records, the metadata, the samples, all that stuff. That is a tremendous amount of work. And we were just a little operation at the time. We didn't have, you know, we didn't really start, you know, I look back, you know, late, there was a point in Rough House where, you know, I had, you know, about, you know, 38, 44 employees at one point. And, you know, counting our national, you know, street reps and all that stuff. But in the early days, we just didn't have the administrative capacity to, you know, to be able to just sign, keep signing people. And we were super, super, we put a lot of thought into our signings. We just didn't, you know, get something and say, oh, wow, we got to have this. I mean, we wanted to know about the artists, wanted to know, you know, what their, you know, their process and what they're about. Because what was important to us is that we wanted self-contained, right? You know, there's labels that are very good at, you know, grooming artists and doing things and you know. But, you know, for us, we wanted the artists that already had an idea of how they wanted to be perceived by their audience, right? And, you know, because we're, you know, look, as much as I'm a fan of the culture and I love the music and everything like that, I'm not the guy who's going to sit there and mix the record for them, right? I'm not the one who's going to tell them what to wear and what to, you know. And we wanted the artist to be as self-contained in that aspect as possible. And so we gravitated towards things that, you know, where we knew we wouldn't have to go out and hire a bunch of producers to make a record and stuff like that.
You are advocates for the artists.
Yeah.
And it's telling in people that you signed and the music they made and the type of, that's important where, you know, you guys, it felt like you guys cared about the artists that you had on your label as opposed to just monopolizing the whole market and just signing whoever you wanted to sign. Like you said, you were from the outside and the people and looking at the history, it was very apparent that you pick and chose the people that you felt fit Rough House in order to make the successes you did.
I think it's also worth saying as well, like, it's not that you didn't see the potential in the groups. You just at the time, you're like, we're full. There's a lot of work that goes into them. Whereas some executives were like, I don't get it. Like, just the other day, I was listening to an interview with L.A. Reid, and he said he didn't get Outkast. It's like, people say, no, give them a chance. He didn't get them. But, you know, what you're saying is that you understood the greatness of an Arrested Development and you saw the potential in the Roots, but you almost just, we can't do this right now. We don't have the capacity, but they still went on to be great elsewhere, which I think is probably a beautiful part of the story.
Yeah, and I'll say this, I always loved the Roots, but the thing is, we had the Fugees, and they were so much alike, and the Fugees was, you know, we already had a challenge there, you know, because, you know, we signed the Fugees, and maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, we signed the Fugees based on the fact that there was something very unique about them and something different, but it wasn't at the time. At the time, if you put the Fugees and the Roots right next to each other, there was a lot of similarities in the two groups. And, you know, I coulda, shoulda, woulda. I mean, it was just, you have to put your resources where you're already committed. And then after that, you know, I don't know if we'd have done any better than Geffen would have done when they're originally on Geffen, you know? Yeah. The other thing is that, you know, again, you can't bite off more than you can chew.
Yeah, yeah, and, no, it's true.
You know, and I had group. Are you guys familiar with the Goats?
Love them. I have a note here about the Goats. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, the Goats, again, self-contained. Everything was right there. You know, I was always into live bands with hip hop. You know, we started with Schoolie doing that. He went on tour with a ska band called. Brain fade, can't remember, but
that's okay.
But you know, it's, again, it's like the Fugees, you know, was live, you know, the Goats were live, and the Roots were a live band as well, but you know, it's too similar, and it was about the allocation of resources.
Okay
I remember, I mean, whether there's any truth to it, I used to record VHS any performance that the Fugees would do on UK television, because you knew that anytime they would do one of their songs, they would do a different version of the song. So if it was Jules Holland, if it was whatever, right? And the Roots used to do something similar. And whether or not they had, not a rivalry, but a competition in terms of the way in which they would perform, especially live.
Yeah.
There were some similarities to that.
I think that goes in part with when you're out touring, right? And you're doing these songs night after night, you start to pick up things. You start to see like audience reaction to certain things. And then you start to develop that. And next thing you know, it's the same song, but it's kind of mutated a little bit, you know, for the purpose of the live show. And I see that in a lot of groups, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Crisscross before. Now, Crisscross are so important to me because they're my entry point into hip hop music.
Right.
So when I heard Crisscross Jump, I was like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. Secondly, similar age. I'm like, I can actually do this. So yeah. that was the start of me actually writing lyrics. And I even wore my jeans backwards, clearly. I remember right. I did that one time and I'm like, don't do that again.
I never did that.
No, I did it, bro. I walked through Harlesden, jeans backwards. Absolute madman. But being in into the music and getting older, I really want to ask you, like, as an outsider now, like, I'm looking into the industry, how big were Crisscross at their peak?
For the age of physical sales, it was one of the fastest selling records in the history of hip hop. I mean, it was like stupid. And it's funny that it blew up before it even hit the radio, because they did a performance on In Living Color, this TV show.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
And nobody knew who they were. And the next day, people were already like calling radio stations and everything like that. And that record just exploded, way beyond anybody's expectations.
Mm. Didn't they go on tour with Michael Jackson at one point?
Yes, they did. Yeah, I went with them to I went on to the tour of Ireland and the UK for their shows.
Oh man, rest in peace, Chris Kelly. I love Crisscross. I was listening to a Young, Rich and Dangerous like just yesterday. That's like one of my favorite albums that a lot of people don't know, and I'm just like, Crisscross,
right?
Such a big impact. And I think it's one of the long-standing qualities of hip-hop music is being able to see yourself in the culture. And Crisscross did that for me, and here I am today. So they do mean a lot to me.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's really the credit for that all goes to Jermaine Dupri, because he conceived it. He basically put it all together. I mean, look, it's no easy feat dealing with kids who are 11 and 12. You know what I mean? Especially in the capacity of being released through a label, through major distribution and radio and touring and all that stuff. And he, you know, it was executed by Jermaine flawlessly.
Jermaine has a rich history in rap way before Crisscross. Mm-hmm. And obviously he came to your attention before Crisscross.
Right.
I never understood, or I don't know the reason why, in research, I think, why didn't Jermaine Dupri sign as a rapper to Rough House?
We did a deal with Jermaine Dupri. We tried to, he was going to be like the first artist.
So what happened?
A lot of people don't know this, and I forget why it never came to fruition, but Jermaine, he started out, his father was the tour manager for Houdini, the Fresh Fest, and Jermaine was a dancer for Houdini. And you know, he was a little, I guess he must have been about 8, 9 years old. I don't know how old he was, actually. I'm just guessing. But Jermaine was, he was producing a group called Silk Times Leather for Geffen Records. And I was doing, back between during the whole schooly thing, I was also doing national mix show promotion and street promotion for labels. And one of the records that I was working were two records for Geffen. One was 783 and one was Silk Times Leather, which was a girls group. And Jermaine was producing Silk Times Leather. And that's how we met him and his father. So, and then there was a group, another Geffen group called 783 that Joe was mixing and I was promoting. That was produced by Muggs, who later on bought us Cypress Hill.
We were talking to them on Clubhouse the other night.
What's that?
We were talking to 783 on Clubhouse just the other night.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've been on Clubhouse a couple of times. I can't find the time to really get on it.
Chris, what we're going to have to do at some point, right? We're going to have to do a room with you, and we're going to do this. We're going to do the stories, and we're going to get the legends in.
Right.
And we're going to get all the legends, because it's a very popular thing, and it's a really good, when we set a time, it's a really good good place to put the information out there. Because right now there's a lot of disinformation.
I know. Twitter. People be wilding up in there. I heard some crazy, crazy things coming from Clubhouse about who, you know, how artists got to the label and stuff like that. The reason I haven't been able to engage in Clubhouse, it's just just during the day and night, I just been, because I'm putting together, like I said, a vinyl distribution thing. I did a new deal with Cypress Hill and B-Real through E1. And I've been so busy, you know, but yeah, that would be awesome. That would.
When the time's right, we're doing a few. We're going to start doing a few. And when the time's right, because I think, like I said, the reason why we're doing this is because it's important for people who hear this from across the world, not just the UK, but for them to hear the stories from the horse's mouth, as it were, and to get the real information. Because I know there are a lot of journalists, a lot of hip-hop fans and legends that would be wowed by the stories that you have. And we're just the conduits to put that out there. It's all you.
Right.
And we will help put that all together, moderate, and make sure no one comes out of turn. But I think that would be excellent.
That'd be awesome.
Okay, we'll talk. Chris.
Cypress Hill.
Yes.
Now, one of the things that really impacted me about Cypress Hill is that they crossed over to like the rock alternative audience, and at the same time they were still distinctly themselves. Like, was that deliberate marketing by the label? And if not, when did you realize? When did you realize?
School ED, for that matter, had a massive white audience. Massive. All his shows were predominantly white people, so Cypress Hill was no surprise to me. You got it. Here's the thing, I used to say this way back in the 80s, that, you know, there was like a core hip hop audience of about 500,000 kids, if you looked at it nationally, right? But there was another 1.5 million white kids that also listened to hip hop, you know? And, you know, there are certain groups that the white alternative rock kids would gravitate towards. And I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, it was, Cypress had, they're very, very unique, very unique. The production, you know, the whole sonic, the way it sounded and everything. And it made absolute sense in terms like the way the Goats, their appeal, you know. Tell you a quick little trivia fact about the Goats. After the Goats, after the second record and they broke up, for the next 10 years or so, we would get more fan mail from all over the world for the Goats, more than Cypress, Criss Cross, and the Fugees combined. And a lot of people find that hard to believe, but it's absolutely true. And I'm talking about Eastern Bloc countries, you know. So you never know where a group's going to resonate with what particular subgenre of the audience and stuff like that. And I think Cypress, it didn't shock me at all.
No, that was always something that interested me. And, you know, you mentioned the Goats. On one of our previous episodes, we were talking about mainstream audiences versus cult audiences or cult followings. And what the Goats have is a cult following. I was at a dinner party before the whole COVID thing happened. I was talking to a friend of mine. Shout out to Paul Eyre. He's a massive Prince fan. We started talking about hip hop. And one of the first things he asked me, he's like, "You need to listen to this album by a group called the Goats. Tricks of the Shade." And, you know, we're here eating little hors d'oeuvres and, you know, rice and curries and all that. And he's like, "Yeah, you got to listen to the Goats." And that's how I actually listened to the Goats. And I'm like, how on earth did I miss this? I only listened to the Goats like in the last 18 months or so. Like, I had no idea.
Listen
about
to the second record too, No Goats, No Glory. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm definitely.
One of the greatest album covers too.
I love a cult following. I do. I think there's a lot more longevity in having a cult following.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Agreed. Submit.
Fugees. We talked about kind of signing them, discovering them. Why do you feel the rap that Blunted Reality gets, is it purely because the score was so impactful?
Yeah.
Because there were some joints on Blunted Reality that people just...
Well, they were remixes that happened later on that kept the album alive. But right. I will say this, okay, about Blunted, is that back in the early days of SoundScan, the way records got tracked, especially in the hip hop world, you know, because it was under the Black Music umbrella, was that it was always considered your first 2 weeks were your biggest weeks that you're going to have, right? In SoundScan, the Goats never had like a, you know, they came out, the record sat there, right? And they went out and toured. But 2.5 years after that record came out, right, and before the score, it was still selling 600 to 800 copies a week on SoundScan, meaning that 600 to 800 people a week were going in to buy that album, right? That is virtually like unheard of for a record that sold as little as it did at the time, right? So what that showed was that they were gaining new fans every day from their live performance, because they toured Europe a bunch of times, and the Fugees, they had real love, I mean, among their live audience. So there was a lot of time, effort, energy, and resources that went into this group, that when before the score came out, that when this, by the time, you know, the score came out, it was just like the perfect storm.
No, fair. In my hand, I hold the cassette, and I've got the vinyl on the back, but this is different, Chris. I was in India when this came out.
I see it. Let me see.
Yeah. This is a different type of case. It's a bit of a thicker case.
Right.
Right. So this was 90 rupees. 90 rupees back then. Well, right now, the going rate is like 70 rupees is a pound.
Right.
So say 90 rupees would be like £1.20.
Right.
Or $1.20. So I bought this back then. This is probably, arguably, the album, especially the skits. This album was everything to me. This album was everything to me. I remember when I was young.
I've never seen packaging
Fuji
like that.
The video.
Neither have I.
Sorry, say that again.
I've never seen packaging like that for a cassette.
I have All Eyes on Me, Life After Death, LL Cool J's albums, all on this type of casing. It's crazy.
It is.
Absolute crazy. I thought you might enjoy it.
No, it's awesome. I love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So back in the day, before, like, you know, I got Carnival here, right? But before they went kind of slimmer, this is how the packaging used to be, especially in India, right? But I remember Fujila. So, you know, I used to love reggae before I started into hip-hop, right? That was my thing. So Fujila hit a bit differently.
Right.
There was a show called Flavor TV. It used to be on Channel 4 in the UK.
Yeah, I remember.
1:30 in the morning. Yep. It used to come on, I think, maybe a Sunday. And they promoted that they were going to have the UK premiere of Fujila. So you know what we did? We put the VCR on timer, recorded it, and when I woke up for breakfast to go to school, what I was doing with my cereal, watching Fujila over and right. over and over again before I went to school. That's how crazy for me, you know, the score and Fuji in particular. So we've talked about discovering, talked about signing. Let's talk a little bit about the sample side, the sampling, because that becomes a massive issue when it comes to the score. Is it true, and whether you know this or not, is it true that for Ready or Not, Enya gets 110% of the publishing because Ready or Not goes into the next song because of the skit and it follows through?
No, it's not. But the first, that Fuji score record and the first Cypress record were both had samples that were not cleared ahead of time. And so the it's a really bad position to be in when you have a song out there and you don't have the rights cleared for it, whether it's a sample or somebody else's song or, you know, or a producer or anything like that. It's just an impossible position to be in. So I don't believe so about the percentages, but I do know that some pretty hefty checks were written, you know.
Got it. Got it. That this things like this is why I think the Clubhouse thing would be so important, because I hear information spurted down. I'm like, where is this coming from? How do you know this? We need to speak to Chris, right?
Right.
But this is why it's so important. But talk to us about the first time you heard the score. When was the first time? I mean, you might have heard it in the process, but...
Yeah, I heard it in the process. I mean, it was... you have to remember the record... Well, let's go before they even embarked on it was that, you know, there was immense pressure from Sony Music to drop the Fugees. And I didn't get it, because I looked at the fact that we were still, again, going back to selling the 600-800 copies a week sound scan, and how their live show had really turned into something like amazing. And you knew you had something amazing. So when we did the exercise, the option, I think the second album, the budget was like $135,000. By this time, they had already gotten to where they, you know, because let's face it, with the Fugees, the creative process never stopped. From the first album through touring, I bought them a portable studio. It's like it was set up in a big road case, and it was a bunch of digital multi-track machines. I forget what we called these. You could do like there was 8 tracks on each one, and I had there was like 3 of them stacked up. So it was like 24 tracks and then some outboard gear and everything like that. And it was all on a road case on wheels that would slide under the tour bus, right? And so they were constantly writing all the time. And so by the time it was, you know, that we exercised the option and gave them the budget to make the second record, they had already had the ideas in place. And, you know, they took their time and, you know, the songs started to trickle in. And one of the things was Killing Me Softly, because even though it wasn't the first designated single on the record, once the vinyl got out there to DJs, you couldn't stop it. You couldn't stop the record. And that's really what, you know, gave it, you know, it caused it to go number one in every country throughout the world. And next thing you know, it's like records going gold and platinum everywhere. And we're not even into the first single Fuji Lai yet. So, yeah, I mean, we knew it was a masterpiece, you know, upon hearing the songs and the way it came together.
How many copies has the score sold to date?
Well, I have to think in the United States, it's approaching diamond. As you know, Miseducation just went diamond.
Congratulations, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. 10 million. And I'll tell you what's unique about the Miseducation going diamond, in that there's only been, I think, since 2004, 5 records that have achieved diamond. And there was only 3 rap records of the 5, and 2 of them were Tupac and Eminem. But those were double album sets, which count as 2 records. So they went diamond just based on 5 million sales of 2 album sets. But I have to think that both records, the score and Miseducation, are, you know, probably up like 30 million worldwide, more so each.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I read on Wikipedia, and I don't trust Wikipedia for the most part. It said about 20 million, and I'm like, nah, it's got to be more than that. It's got to be.
Yeah, but you got to remember the Wikipedia, that's old.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But it's one of those things where...
This is why we have Chris.
When I was going to record stores, I always used to, and this might be a naive way of looking at things, but I always looked at what was in stock and how much. And I would constantly see the score being bought. Like, I'm talking over a period of years. I bought the score 3 times, and I'm one person. So I'm thinking, if I bought it 3 times, you've got people out there that will buy the CD, they'll buy the vinyl, they'll buy the digital. Then I went out and bought the bootleg versions twice. I'm like, it's got to be more than that.
Okay, let's talk about this, shall we?
He's holding up the vinyl copy of Halftime by Nasty Nas, just for the benefit.
Can I see that again? Let me see that cover again.
So it's the Mucha Mixers on here, the instrumental, the Large Professor version. We've also got the Rough House with the kind of, I guess it's a blue.
Yeah, that's our label.
That's it. Because I remember, and I'm like, Rough House? Fugees? Tim Dog? You know? Outsiders, you know, all of that. Right. So my understanding is it involved a cassette. There was a meeting with you. So let's talk about you signing Nas. Search, Faith Newman.
Yep.
And Nasir Jones. Was it in Philly? In a diner in Philly?
Yes. I'll tell you what happened. For 8 weeks prior to this meeting, I had a friend who owned a nightclub, and he was always, he managed a club actually. We used to hang out till the wee hours in the morning, partying and doing all sorts of stupid stuff. And he was always playing me live at the barbecue. And he was saying, man, you got to find this kid Nas. And I assumed that Nas was signed to Stu Fine and Wild Pitch, right? And so one day the president of Columbia Records calls me up and he said, Don Einar, he said, I want you to have a meeting with MC Search and Faith Newman about this rap artist named Nas. And I was like, huh? What? Like, really? Yeah, sure. Awesome. So they come down to Philly and we go out to eat. We hang out. And, you know, I was like super excited and we did this deal. And so Nas is a Rough House artist. And we so it was like it was two things that happened. Search had a soundtrack that he was working on called Zebrahead. It was a movie starring Michael Rapaport, and it was about a white kid kind of involved in hip hop culture and everything. And so we did a deal. We signed Nas as an artist, and we did a deal for this to distribute the soundtrack for Zebrahead. And we, you know, we were going to Nas do the first song, Halftime. So we put Halftime out. It does really well. And we're making Nas's record. And at one point I got, they sent me like five or six songs. And John Schechter from The Source comes by my office and I give him a copy of the five songs on the DL. I said, you can't really play this for anybody, you know, but it's for you because The Source, you know, I sent out the first copy of The Source for them with School ED in the School ED retail mailings when it was just a newsletter. And so I find out later on that Dave Mays had called Donnie and said, we're putting Nas on the cover of The Source. And Nas is going to be huge and everything. And the reason Sony, Columbia Records, directed Faith and Search to bring Nas to us is because they didn't want to sign Nas. They weren't, you know, they didn't really right. get it. And they felt that, okay, well, if you put it on Rough House, if the project fails, we can just deduct all the losses from Rough House, from the money that we owe Rough House, right? But I guess what they weren't counting on was that Nas already had like a big name in the streets, and you know, and then Halftime came out, and now everybody's talking about Nas, and they realized that they had kind of like screwed the pooch in a way. So basically, they kind of, you know, at the time, I had a lot of big records and I had a lot of stuff going on, and my relationship with Sony was really important, you know, and I also admittedly was a little bit of a wimp. And they kind of bullied me into selling them back to Contract, which I did. And the reason for that being, and I've had to explain this in many interviews, is that, you know, my relationship with Columbia was super, super important because we were doing so well. I didn't realize that I had the juice to say, no, we're keeping it. You know what I mean? Because they really kind of like put me through the ringer in terms of like, you know, Donnie says I'm in trouble with corporate on this and you need to help me out and stuff like that. So we caved and we sold him back the contract.
Did you ever have a conversation with Nas after about that?
Oh, yeah. Every time I saw him, he'd say, oh, man, I wanted to stay on Rough House. I wanted to stay on Rough House. And I didn't even realize at the time it was that important to him. You know what I mean? But apparently when I saw him in Europe a couple times, because, you know, he toured with the Fugees and everything. And, yeah. But, you know, all's well that ends well. I mean, he went out and he obviously has a massive career and he's still relevant till this day. And he's a leading tech entrepreneur and, you know, very happy for him.
Yeah. He would have been a really good fit, like a long-term fit on Rough House.
Oh, I know.
He would have been perfect. And just think about...
Chris knows.
What do you mean?
He knows. Listen, look at the resume. He knows.
We've talked about Michael, this already. Michael Ball, Jermaine's father, one time, we were sitting in a hotel and he said to me, he goes, imagine if you'd had Arrested Development. House of Pain.
you would have monopolized everything.
Yeah.
Every audience, you would have had the street audience, the alternative audience, the roots.
But you know what? I was happy with our little slice of the pie, though.
Okay. All right. I know you've mentioned Nas, House of Pain, Arrested Development. Just to make sure we've cleared the slate and left it clean. Are there any other artists that you tried to sign that got away from you?
Well, it's funny. I had a interesting LinkedIn conversation with Matthew Knowles, and you know he's on LinkedIn, and I you know texted him and introduced myself, and he came back telling me that he goes, "You don't remember me," and I said, no, Mr. Knowles, I don't remember you. And he goes, well, you passed on Destiny's Child. And then he says, I even have the pass letter to prove it. And well, I'm going to tell you this, anybody that knew me back in the day knows that I didn't do pass letters. You know what I mean? I thought pass letters were like a pussy move. And if I wasn't interested in not signing an artist, it was somebody that we were in active discussions with, I would call them up and tell them, you know, instead of pass letter. I mean, pass letter, it's like, you know, yeah. So that didn't happen. But for some reason, he's got it in his mind that we did. And it was the group had a different name, but I would have remembered. I would have remembered a father coming in with his, you know, with his daughter and her group in her. I would have remembered that. I know it didn't happen, but anyhow.
But he's convinced that you turned down Destiny's Child.
Yeah, but you know what's funny? He was kind of like, you know, he was a little belligerent in his verbiage. And I was like, really? Like, let's just say that did happen, right? What do you care at this point?
I mean, come on, Destiny's Child.
But the thing is, I think what it is I think it's like us. Everyone knows what Rough House meant to music, to hip hop, to people coming up. We all knew. And sometimes, like, legends and people in the game, they always have this, I guess, it's like a romance affair that they wish, like if I was a rapper, I would have loved to have been on Rough House or Loud or something like that, right? Because of the mystique and the people they had. And I think for Mr. Knowles, it might have been that.
And also,
that he still,
before I hand
over. You guys ever interview Steve from Loud?
Rifkin?
Yeah.
I've interviewed Steve Rifkin in a previous life, like 10 years ago.
You should talk to him again. You should talk to him again.
We did. I did. We did. I screwed the pooch on that one.
I like that term. Screwed the pooch.
Yeah. I screwed the pooch on that one, Chris.
I'm gonna get into my nerd bag, Mr. Schwartz.
Dig in.
There was a group on your label called The Outsiders.
Yes.
Now I am.
Yes.
When it comes to The Outsiders, right? I thought these guys are gonna be huge, 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 huge. Eminem, Ra Digger, you know, Desperados, Pace One, This Is How the West Was Won, Armado, True Desperado. Yeah. Like, they're going to be huge.
Yeah, Cowboys, that was on the score, yeah.
Right. I feel, and I'm going to say this respectfully, The Outsiders could have been bigger. Like, looking back.
Well, it's funny you say that. I felt that too. And, you know, and I love those guys to death. We did a tour with Method Man Redman, and I wrapped a big tour bus with the artwork from the Nightlife EP, and they were doing all the House of Blues venues across the United States, and they got to the very first one in Chicago, and one of the guys from The Outsiders punched a security guard and he got kicked off the tour. And we did another record, The Bricks, and you know, but The Outsiders, they were, of all the groups I've had, and as talented as they were and everything, they were a little bit of a handful, you know, and they kind of just imploded. It wasn't me, you know, it wasn't, I would have gone on to make other records with them. And, but I was always a huge, huge fan of the group, always loved the group. And, they, you know, I'm always proud that they're a part of the whole Rough House pedigree.
Pace One, said on a Ra Digga record, and this is a line that I've always wanted to know what he meant. He said, break your team up like Chris Schwartz and Joe Nicolo. And he said that in 2000. Do you know of that line and, you know, what he was possibly referring to?
Break your team up. Oh, he meant Joe and I splitting up.
Okay.
That's what he was talking. Yeah, he meant.
That's fine. So it's as simple as that. I thought it was some deep subliminal, like.
No.
Okay.
It's really interesting, the relationship you have with Jersey. And I know Philly, from a geographical perspective, Philly and Jersey, they're in close proximity. But from your time pressing and going to press implants in your early days to the Fugees, to the Outsiders, New Jersey and Philly, you have a very rich connection there.
Yes. Philadelphia is just recently was nominated by the RIAA and Nielsen as being the second biggest music market in the country, with Los Angeles being first. And the reason being is because the way we're geographically located. We're right next to Jersey, obviously. Then you have Delaware and Western Pennsylvania. So it's a, and then you're our proximity in New York. So we're a massive music market. But, you know, the thing about Philadelphia is also one of the hardest markets for to break our artists on radio. And that's for any genre of music. But yeah, I mean, Jersey has always played a big part in the Rough House story. Yeah, I mean, started early with depressing plants over in Jersey, and then the artists and everything. As a matter of fact, there's a group that I'm looking at right now from North Jersey called the Hot Boy Mafia. And not to be confused with another Hot Boy Mafia from the Bay Area, this is the Hot Boy Mafia that I'm talking about. They're a Spanish language hip hop group, and they're awesome. And I love what they do. And I'm trying to put something together with them right now. If you look them up, they have a song called Bando.
Right.
Bando, yeah, B-A-N-D-O.
Okay, Bando, Hot Boy Mafia, got it. Got it. I have another nerd question. Call of the Wild. What happened to that album? I need it in my life.
Oh, Call of the Wild. That was a Muggs. That was Soul Assassins, and that was Muggs' group. And we did a record, you know. And, you know, just sometimes things don't happen the way you want them to, you know. But, you know, we gave it its due, and the record went out there, and it had pockets, you know, but just not enough to, you know, to want to keep going. But also that record happened right before the brink of when Joe and I split up.
Understood. Okay. All right. That makes sense. That makes sense.
And we had the label closure and then the reactivation with Beanie Siegel. Before we get there, what were the lessons you learned from signing DMX?
From DMX?
Yeah.
DMX. You know, and I tell you, I Born Loser, I love that. I love that record till this day. It's one of my favorite hip hop records. DMX was kind of like out of sight, out of mind for us, because it was bought into us by a guy named Kurt Woodley, who was from New York, who's one of our A&R people. And, you know, the record went out there, we put it out, and it got, you know, it got some attention, but by the time his option came up, he was already in the thick of it with the folks from Rough Riders. And, you know, so we didn't really exercise the option on it, and he was already dealing with them. And I'll say this, all right, that I think that for him as an artist, he was in a much better situation with Rough Riders, since they did an amazing job with him.
Agreed. Yeah, I think so. But you're still a part of the DMX story. Still a big part.
Yeah.
And again, it talks about the legacy of the label and the impact you had in, I guess, this tri-state, but then also going into Philly, right? So, because it's not so far. So the legacy of the label still rings true. And I think, as we're rounding up, because I am conscious of time, and we will do that. We will talk again, Chris. There is no doubt.
That's
we will
fine,
talk again.
Man.
It's Clubhouse on air. We will talk again. But I think we want to end on the legacy of the label. And for me, it's the output, but speaking to you, I'm very cognizant of the fact that everything you did, even the, I guess, the artist that you passed up on, quote unquote, you guys are music people. and the output you've had on that label and will continue to have with Rough Nation, I think it's important to note, like Chris said, you didn't just pass on someone because you didn't see it. You saw it and understood, right, this is their path, this is our path, and you're responsible for so much greatness within rap. And I think that's a wonderful legacy to be a part of, because
yeah.
I've never heard anyone say anything to the contrary about you guys, about, you know, I mean, apart from Mr. Knowles now, apart from, you know, the past, right? But he probably heard that from Clubhouse, and then someone probably made something up, right? But neither here or there.
No, this was long before Clubhouse. This was last year. Yeah.
I just want to say Clubhouse because it's a new thing to say, Clubhouse. But genuinely speaking, I think what you guys, I was talking to my wife, who's not a hip hop head by any stretch of the imagination, knows who some of these artists are. But when I was breaking down your story to her, and the albums and the artists that you've been part of, or whose journey you've been part of and helped along, she was just like, wow. And that's the legacy, is that you have been that person for all of these people. And I love what Cypress Hill said. I think it was in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, how they shouted you and Joe out. And I think that's a testament and the legacy you guys have put. And I think the reason why I wanted you on it, and the reason why me and Chrissy wanted you on it, is for that very purpose. Everyone talked about Score and All Eyes on Me and all this, and they're supposed to. But you also have to talk to the people that allowed that and enabled that, enabled those behaviors to thrive. And that's Rough House.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
Well, I'm writing a new book. It's called From Rebels and Poets to Kingpins and Moguls. And it's about really the kind of like the start and the evolution of the hip hop economy, and how hip hop was really the first genre of music to create its own economy. When you come right down to it, it's never happened before. And you look at it from the very beginning, from the intrepid entrepreneurs who started to now, you have, you know, these artists and label owners who are like hip hop industrialists, for lack of a better term. So when that comes close to fruition, we need to talk about that again. You know, that would be fun.
Would love to.
That would be excellent. Because we were moderators on a Clubhouse room early this afternoon about hip hop, the culture, and business obviously comes up, and independent artists and how to do this. And I think that information and understand the history of it, and then think about tangible solutions. I'm down.
It would be awesome.
Absolutely.
Chris, thank you so much for your time.
Guys, thank you. Thank you very much, Summit. Chris, this is really, really fun. No,
it's all good. I'm going to leave you to it. I'm going to go listen to some Psycho Realm and just go about my day.
Okay. I'll talk to you guys later. Have a good one.
Peace.
See ya.
A big thanks to Chris. Wow. There's some gems in that one, bro.
Many jewels. OC would be proud.
OC would be proud. I'm going to send this to OC. I'm going to send this to OC. He's one of the greatest MCs ever.
Come on now.
To grace the earth.
Come on now.
But there's so much to unpack about that episode. I'm not even sure where to start.
Don't. Let it resonate. Let it marinate.
You have to let it marinate. I'm telling you, this guy's a leader. Mm. He knew. Just, it didn't work at this point. Or he may, like, the bullying thing about Sony and Nas, it doesn't sit right with me, because I have a certain feeling towards bullying in music and the industry, but that happens and it still happens.
But bro, like, come on, man. Like, think about it like this. The people who he couldn't sign or he was unable to sign went on and had great careers elsewhere. So that's still a part of his legacy. And think about it. Sometimes it's like, the way I see it is that sometimes the things you may quote unquote turn away add value elsewhere. So think about the other places he's added value without necessarily being there. That's part of his legacy too. Like Q-Tip. They wanted him on Lab Cab in California. Farside reached out to Q-Tip, said, listen, we want you as part of this album. I'm busy on The Infamous. But you know what? I know a guy called JD. Q-Tip not being available added greatness even in his absence.
Yeah.
I'm preaching, sorry.
No, as you should. You need to give me some douce though, innit? So I can get some of that.
No. I've got some liquor here with me now, some Cuban rum and some Coke, bruv. I'm open. But you know what? Big up to Chris, though. He was a real one with his
He was, right?
With his green hat. Was it green? Yeah. Green beanie hat and that.
It's green. But
Chris
no,
Schwartz and that. That's a serious name, you know.
Listen, he's a serious person in this game.
Bruv. Chris Schwartz, bruv.
He's done a lot and...
Sounds rich.
Like I said, like we said prior to the start of the episode, Guru and him going at us, you know, individuals, I don't know, made me think, hey, man, I need to say something about some things that I need to get off my chest. But speaking to Chris just now, it's warmed my heart where I wasn't angry, by the way, just to let you know, when I tweet stuff like that, I'm not angry. I'm perfectly content. But just hearing that history, it just, for the fan in me, we keep saying this, food for thought, soul food. That's what it is for me.
Okay.
You know, all right. That's important to me. I'm very passionate about the hip hop colonizers.
Let's talk.
Well, it's this thing, right? Say what I said. If you don't know what I said, read it on Twitter. But essentially, there's people fetishizing rap, hip hop culture. There are people who are trying to corner the market, thinking that they know it. Just because you want to be cool, bro. Did you just hear the listen to Chris Schwartz speak. This is a man who's done so much in the game. He don't care about cornering a market. He wants to put out good music. But do you know what I mean? Like, when people are not cool and people feel like something belongs to them and they appropriate slang and language, not knowing where it comes from.
I saw a Twitter bio the other day.
Mm.
And I won't say who it is. I'll tell you off air. Not because I'm scared, by the way. I'll just tell you who it is off the air.
I understand.
A cultured hood rat. That's what they call themselves.
Yeah, see. You see what I'm saying?
Cultured hood rat.
We're on the chatty house. We talk to people, and there's a growing theme about the realness of rap. And this conversation has been going for like 20 years, right? And it bugs the hell out of me because it exists. And I don't think a culture that is pure as rap could be fake anyway. But that's a different story. It's people. We can't do nothing about those people. However, when you are supposed to be of the culture, say that you're of the culture, hide behind the fact that you're for the culture, yet are doing things, or your actions don't match your words. And this is a number of people. It's not one individual, but it's a number of people.
Ubiquitous whack MCs.
Yes, exactly. You have to understand, people died over this shit. People are still dying over it. And so when you're in the comfort of your own home with the heater on, where these people are trying to find a way out of their social and economical circumstances, and you play with it like that, it pisses me off.
Okay. I hear you.
Because I'm not black. Of course, look at my face.
You could never be black, bruv. You're mad. You don't want to. Right. You're mad, bruv.
But it's
I'm messing.
It's empathy. It's seeing something from a different perspective.
Right.
And I have people I've seen stories. I've heard stories. I've been in situations like, this is not cool, bro. And when we're talking about chatty house or in with friends about the culture and realness has to come back and all this stuff, and I don't like how everyone just keeps reverting to Cardi B or Meg Thee Stallion.
Yeah,
or any
leave
female
them alone,
person.
Man. Leave them alone, man. Like, bro, like everyone's talking about, you know, Cardi B talks about this and Cardi B talks about that, and I'm like, well, you know, I'll say it on air. Hardcore by Lil Kim was the first album me and my friends ever stole from the shop. Statute of Limitations and all that.
I think
stylistically, I prefer Lil Kim's music, but it takes all different types of people for the world to go around. And what I don't like is when you play women off each other. Oh, but look at Rhapsody. Listen, bruv. When I was at the Jazz Cafe and Rhapsody was performing, she pulled a guy out of the crowd and started whining on him.
Mm.
Rhapsody, bro. She's a woman.
Leave
them alone, bruv. Just leave them alone.
Leave everyone alone.
And be
leave
the change you want to see. Leave them alone.
Leave
them
everyone
alone. I was listening to Mobb Deep today.
Mm.
And I was reminiscing on my experience listening to The Infamous. Do you know what The Infamous did for me, bro? And I know I'm pointing it at the screen, innit?
Go on.
But, you know. It made me join the choir. I heard The Infamous and I said, you know what? This life sounds stressful. I don't want to be a part of it. But then even being able to join a choir made me recognize my privilege, because there's people who grew up in those situations who cannot even identify a way out. And yeah. It humbled me immediately. I said, you know what? I'm very fortunate.
And that's what I mean. And that's what I mean. People are playing with this. They don't understand it. They don't understand the Black or Latino experience from back when this started. And it's cool to be a hip-hop fan. It's cool to know shit about the Far Side or whoever.
It's cool to be... What I'm finding is people, and not everybody, so when I say people, it's the people I'm referring to.
Yeah.
They want to be known for being into hip-hop culture than actually being into hip-hop culture.
There it is.
You know, like, they'll wake up at 4 a.m. and be like, yeah, man. Man just woke up, innit? Listening to Brother Lynch Hung. Brother, it's 4 a.m. You're not listening to Brother Lynch Hung at 4 a.m. Please relax. Stop trying so hard. Be yourself.
Be yourself. No. Facts. I'm, and you know what now? I'm going to start. Is we are all smart individuals. And if there are people out there who start to associate with these colonizers, and you can't see their colonizers for whatever reason because they haven't shown themselves to you, bro, in the music industry, if you're good in the music industry, no matter what part of it you are in, not MCs, not DJ, I'm talking about A&Rs, publicists, managers, whoever. When you're in music and you do it well, you're a good people's person for the most part. Some people are assholes, but the music industry will teach you a lot about people. And people's skills, and to recognize and red flags, and this person's cool and this person isn't. If you still choose to associate with hip hop colonizers, despite the fact that I guess music is a fast track into a degree and to know how to deal with people, then you are part of the problem too.
Okay.
Because this is enough's a fucking enough. You're telling me bro. What did Q-Tip say? What rule was it? Industry number
4,080.
Right? Record labels are still shady?
People too. I was lamenting on your hip-hop colonizer theory, and I thought about how the British Empire moved. You know, just going around the world, acting mad, carving up countries, renaming them. You stay over there, we've got this part, and the music business and the entertainment business is kind of pretty much the same. It's like you carve stuff up and this is ours, this is yours, you stay in that box, we'll rename, reposition, reappropriate in the name of commerce and not culture. So it's a sticking point for me as well, but I guess I'm just a bit exhausted, and I also have to protect my, and I don't want to sound... like I'm just, you know, spewing the timeline. But I've got to also protect my energy because I read things differently and I bear the burdens of people that I don't even know, and I can't live like that.
That we all process things differently, and we're all... Go on.
I was going to say the colonizers, yeah? Them forget box.
They're going to get boxed up.
Yeah, them forget box. Them forget box and that MFS.
Listen, I don't know what people are going to say. Who are you? Right? They're going to say to me, who are you to even think about fixing your face to say anything about hip-hop colonizers? That's what they're going to say to me. And I understand.
To you? Why?
Yeah, to me. Why should I be the voice of someone trying to drive out colonizers or to make them feel uncomfortable? That's what they'll say to me.
Are you trying to be the voice?
No, I'm not trying to be the voice. But it hit me. I was like, what would Royce of 5'9 say to me? If I was talking to Royce of 5'9 about hip-hop colonizers, what would be his first thing he would say to me? I think he would say, but who are you? That's what makes me think. People might say that to me too.
I think you have a point, but here's how I think about things. And sometimes I can get defensive about things, but I think about, is the person and what they're saying, are they wrong? Are they fundamentally wrong for what it is they're saying? Is it inaccurate? Is it incorrect? Oh, it's true? Oh, because they don't have 100,000 followers on Twitter, I shouldn't listen, or I shouldn't take it on board. And this is the problem we have now, where you have people who are uninformed leading these discussions. You know, oftentimes you have people say, I'm here to learn, or I'm here to listen. Well, guess what, bro? Sometimes you can't do all three. You can't learn, listen, and lead at the same time. Sometimes you just got to sit down and hear and see what's going on. Like, I know a lot of people want to talk about, oh, they were here for this and you weren't outside for that. Well, guess what? Just because you were in something doesn't mean you were paying attention. There's unwritten laws. There's things going on outside of this music that you have to be sensitive to.
Yes. Agreed. Agreed.
The intangible tangibles. You've got to be sensitive. And that's the thing about culture. It's such a widely encompassing entity, and it means so many different things to people. It's not just music, it's fashion, it's culinary diet, it's how you walk, it's how you
talk. It's a way of life. Bro, it's a way of life to choose.
If I come to your house, I'm going to greet your wife and your family in a certain way. Why? Because of how I was raised. Culture. Mm-hmm. If I ring your house, it's not going to be, yes, bro, let me chat. It's going to be, good evening, may I speak to so-and-so? Because that's the way I was raised, in my culture. Mm-hmm. However, culture can be appropriated for one's use and benefit as they see fit. Unfortunately.
Yes, it can be.
But I don't want to be a Debbie Downer.
Yeah, but it's okay. Sometimes we have to have the conversation, right? It just so happens that it's happening on in the episode which was legendary with Chris Schwartz.
Yeah, that was a really really good interview, man. I really enjoyed speaking to him. And as a fan, it's kind of, I had some moments in that interview where I had to just process, like, hold on. You're telling me that, like, this is the guy that helped put together the album that I listened to on the 220 bus when I was going to school. Like, this is the guy that signed off on it. Nuts. Nuts.
That's what I told him the story about Flavor TV. That's real spit. That's real spit. Like, breakfast, having my cereal, watching that. We used to be number 10. Like, come on, man. Like,
bro. Bro, I was listening to Cowboys, you know. And, bruv, why did the tune open up with yodeling, bruv? Odilehi. Bruv. What?
Dude, listen, I think, you know what?
Odilehi. Bro, how you going to start? How you going to start a verse like that?
I don't know, man. I think at some point before the year is out, we should just talk about the source. The score.
Odilehi.
Mr. You end with Mr.
Mister, can I borrow $5 so I have something to eat? Then he starts swearing at the man.
How many mics do we rip on the deli?
I get mad frustrated when I rhyme. Bro, family business. Lauren's verse, she left Earth, bruv. She left Earth, bruv. Lauren said on the Ready or Not remix, and this is going to be the last thing I said, she said, if I could change the times and make rhymes raise the babies, give all the pigs rabies, send by in niggas to Hades, clothe young ladies, chase the rainbow, find a pup, three the third time offender once he learned the mix a lot. Bruv? I'm done.
You can follow us on social media at Break the Atoms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Chris's personal is at I Am Kinetic. Mine is at Hip Hop Chronicle. That's the same for the Chatty House. If you want to join us there.
No colonizers allowed, innit?
No. We're not doing that. But sincerely appreciate each and every one of you for tuning in, for rocking with us.
Our listeners aren't colonizers.
No, they're no, absolutely not. That's why this is podcast. That's why this is podcast.
Odilehi.
Exactly. Again, thank you to Chris. Make sure you tune and make sure you stay in tune with his new book coming out, everything that Rough Nation does. Go listen to the old albums, purchase them a few more times.
Also, thank you to everyone who streamed my new single. It did numbers, bro.
Yeah, congrats.
Thank you, man. Thank you, man. No odilehi. None of that.
With that, we'll be back next week with more episodes. Until then, peace.
Peace.